Well, I am the author of two books on U.S. foreign policy. One is called Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Interventions Since World War II. The other book is called Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. I was working at the State Department in the 1960s, planning to become a Foreign Service officer, but I left that job and that ambition because of Vietnam, and then I began to write for the underground press, eventually turning to books.
Your current book, Rogue State, seems very appropriate to what's been happening lately.
Yeah, the first chapter in the book, after the introduction, is called Why Do Terrorists Keep Picking on the United States? And I've sent that chapter out on the internet somewhat.
Can we go over what exactly you cover in that chapter?
Well, the main point of it is that the terrorists, whatever else one might want to say about them, they're also rational human beings, which means that they have a reason. I mean, in their own minds, they have a reason for doing what they do. And they have good reason, I argue, for hating not America, but American foreign policy. I think when they speak about hating America, that's what they mean. And I give in this chapter a long list of things which the U.S. foreign policy has done to the Middle East, and there's no telling which of these has influenced individual terrorists more than others, but I can give you the list if you want to hear it. It's not that long.
Yeah, that would be great.
This is just for the past 20 years. There's as much before the past 20 years, but I just chose that period. The shooting down of two Libyan planes in 1981, the bombardment of Beirut in 1983 and 84, the bombing of Libya in 1986, the bombing and sinking of an Iranian ship in 1987, the shooting down of an Iranian passenger plane in 1988, the shooting down of two more Libyan planes in 89, the massive bombing of the Iraqi people in 1991, the continued bombings and sanctions against Iraq, including the day before the recent attack in New York and Washington, the bombing of Sudan and Afghanistan in 98, the habitual support of Israel despite the devastation and routine torture inflicted upon the Palestinian people by Israel, the condemnation of Palestinian resistance to these things, the abduction of wanted men from Muslim countries such as Malaysia, Pakistan, Lebanon, and Albania, and finally the large military and high-tech presence in Islam's holiest land, Saudi Arabia, and elsewhere in the Persian Gulf region. These are some of the American actions that can turn an Arab or a Muslim into a fanatic, into a terrorist, into a decrier of America, the great Satan. And the terrorist attacks against the U.S. are never going to end until we stop intervening in civil wars and other matters which are none of our business.
In addition to that, I believe you cover that there's been several efforts to put together anti-terrorist conferences that, on one instance in 1996 that the U.S. was a part of, that had a lot of hypocrisy involved in it.
Yeah, the U.S. behavior toward terrorism has been quite ambiguous. In the same chapter, I was just reading from, there's a section called Good and Bad Terrorists. One example I give of ambiguity of U.S. policy, in 1996, the U.S. assembled 27 world leaders in Egypt at an anti-terror conference after a wave of suicide bombers had killed dozens of people in Israel. And at the conference, President Clinton said, "We must be clear in our condemnation of those who resort to terror. Violence has no place in the future we all seek in the Middle East," unquote. But at the very same time, in Iraq, the U.S. was supporting with millions of dollars the Iraqi National Accord, which was using car bombs and other bombings in Baghdad and other cities, trying to destabilize Saddam Hussein. It was estimated that the bombings had taken the lives of more than 100 civilians in Baghdad alone during the preceding few years. And then 2 weeks after this conference, the same countries met in Washington for a follow-up on counterterrorism, and amongst the topics they discussed were the flow of funds to terrorist groups. Of course, there was no mention of the flow of funds from Washington to such groups.
Then I believe sometime after that, President Clinton signed the anti-terrorist bill?
Yeah, also in 96, which was and remains a body blow to civil liberties in the U.S. In many ways, against aliens and people seeking asylum and American prisoners. All kinds of people have been hurt by that law, and it bars financial transactions between American corporations and countries accused of supporting terrorism. And then 4 months after the bill was passed, the Clinton administration quietly exempted Sudan to allow a U.S. oil company to negotiate an oil deal. At the same time, Syria was granted an exemption to encourage participation by Damascus in the Middle East process. So they had this law which bars American corporations from doing business with countries accused of supporting terrorism, but as soon as it helps American corporations, they waive the law.
What was the impetus at the time in passing the anti-terrorism bill? Was there specific incidents that had led
The bombing in Oklahoma City was probably the main motivation. Of course, that was done by an American, and the law is aimed mainly at foreigners, although it's not by name, but that's who it's been applied against mainly. It's very ironic.
Again, in your book, we jump forward to February 2000, where there was a group of significant number of nations that got together to try and do a terrorist conference.
There was a proposal for a major international conference to combat terrorism. And on this occasion, the U.S. was quick to throw cold water on the very idea, saying it would have no practical benefits. The proposed conference was backed by the 119-member non-aligned movement of third world nations. One of the issues that the conference hoped to address was how to distinguish between a terrorist and a freedom fighter, citing the examples of Hezbollah and Hamas groups fighting Israel. The question of state terrorism also loomed as a possible issue at the conference. For example, should military attacks by armed forces of any state be deemed acts of terrorism when civilians are killed? The 1999 NATO bombing of Yugoslavia had been discussed as a case in point. So there you have reason all by itself for the U.S. to boycott this conference.
And yet it seems like what they were discussing is exactly what we're dealing with now. Whole concept of terrorists or freedom fighters who have attacked the U.S.
Right, exactly. We all know the old expression, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter.
So the current aim of the U.S. media currently is that it's Arab terrorists and Osama bin Laden, who's the target of most of the media coverage, and they seem to brush over the fact that he was a byproduct of the U.S. efforts?
Well, I don't think it's being brushed over. I mean, it's now pretty well commonly discussed and mentioned that he was one of the Mujahideen whom the U.S. supported in the 1980s against the government of Afghanistan, which was supported by the Soviet Union. Yeah. But what isn't mentioned in these stories, though, that government which the U.S. overthrew was the last chance Afghanistan had for entering the 20th century. It was a secular government. It was in favor of the emancipation of women. It was in favor of the separation of church and state. It was involved in land reform. It was a fairly progressive government, but it was not hostile to the Soviet Union. They were friends with it, and so that was the reason the U.S. stepped in and caused the Soviet Union to invade so that the U.S. would have an excuse to overthrow the government. And when I speak of them giving the Soviet Union cause to invade, I'm referring to an admission to this about 3 years ago by Zbigniew Brzezinski, who in 1979 was the National Security Advisor for Jimmy Carter. And he was bragging 3 years ago in an interview how he had undertaken a campaign to instigate the Soviet Union in Afghanistan by supporting various rebel groups against the government. And he says he was fully aware that this might lead to a Soviet incursion into Afghanistan, and he was hoping they would because he wanted to give the Soviet Union a taste of their own Vietnam. That's how he put it. And this worked very well. The Soviets invaded, and then the CIA undertook a massive campaign to create an army to fight against the government, and eventually this army won. The people of Afghanistan lost. I mean, half the population was either killed, wounded, or refugees. But the U.S. called that a victory, and Osama bin Laden was one of the members of the Mujahideen, which is a sort of a blanket term for all these fighters against the government. It means holy warriors. It's not clear to what extent, if any, he was singled out by the CIA as one of their liaisons, but he spent most of the war in Pakistan in a support position, and he also was providing much money. That was his connection to the CIA and this war. His connection is no secret. I mean, that's been mentioned more and more by the mainstream press. But what they haven't mentioned is what I just said a few moments ago about the kind of government which the CIA helped to overthrow.
As well as they seem to fail to mention the fact that in addition to bin Laden, that they produced about 10,000 other freedom fighters like himself?
Yeah, which have spread all over the world, and they have engaged in numerous acts of terrorism. These veterans of the war in Afghanistan, they've been using the weapons they acquired there and the training they got from the CIA and the CIA's allies, and they've engaged in terrorist acts all over the place. But I must point out that this, too, has not been totally obscured by the American media. The LA Times, for example, a few years ago had a long series of articles on this very phenomenon. You know, I mention these things pointing out what the media has mentioned, but, you know, we have to keep in mind that these are very infrequent exceptions. The LA Times stories, you know, maybe one out of 1,000 papers in America which carried such stories. But one cannot say that there's been a total censorship of these things. If you look for them, as I do, you'll find some things.
So what other items about the current situation is the media not giving us the facts on?
Well, if you mean specifically what took place 2 weeks ago, there have been all kinds of questions raised by some conspiracy theorists, and I don't use that word pejoratively, raising questions about the possible foreknowledge of the CIA and Mossad, the Israeli intelligence service. Both the officials and the public in Israel have made it plain that they're not terribly upset over what happened. They find some relief. This, in the Washington Post, they quoted people saying that they are relieved that now the people in the U.S. or in the West will know what Israel faces. Like many other people, they're seeing what happened here as a microcosm of Israel versus the Palestinians. And the Palestinians are, of course, the terrorists. And the Israelis are, of course, the innocent victims. And so they are pleased that this has been put on the world stage, and they're hoping that this will help their cause. But I think it may be just the opposite. I just read a long editorial in the Boston Globe, which, as you may know, is owned by the New York Times, which mentions the expressions of satisfaction coming from Israel about what happened, but they say this may backfire, and I think it will. This editorial was calling for regarding the Palestinians with a bit more sympathy. Because, you know, even though the media may deny for the most part that these terrorists had good reasons for doing what they do, good in their own minds, I think it's becoming clearer and clearer that they're being forced to think, because of the very degree of horror of what happened, they're being forced to think, well, why do these people hate us so? And more and more this question is coming to the forefront, even in the mainstream media. And I think slowly but surely they're being forced to face certain questions which in the past they have not faced, and including the Palestinian-Israeli question from the Palestinians' point of view. So I think the Israelis' optimism about what might result from this may backfire.
I just want to remind our listeners that we're talking with Bill Bloom, who is the author of Rogue State, A Guide to the World's Only Superpower. Well, getting back to your book, I think it really clearly illustrates so many reasons why so many people in the world would hate the U.S. And one of those...
Yeah, but you must point out, as I said, it's U.S. foreign policy that they hate. It's not they hate every American or every building here or every school. I mean, it's what America does to the world in its foreign policy that causes the hatred.
Thank you. So one of the things that U.S. policy has is our training bases here in the U.S., and one perfect example is the School of the Americas.
That's mainly dealing with Latin America. You know, I made a speech a few days ago on a campus where I mentioned that the people of Latin America have as much reason to hate the U.S., maybe even more so than people in the Middle East, because of what the government has done, the U.S. government has done to Latin America over the past 50, 60 years, and that if the Latin Americans had the same belief as many people in the Middle East do, that one will go to heaven if one sacrifices one's life in killing the enemy and becoming a martyr. So Latin Americans had that same belief. I think in the past half century you would have had countless examples of suicide terrorist acts against the U.S. coming from south of the border. Of course, as I say, the American foreign policy has done even more harm in Latin America than it has in the Middle East. And the School of the Americas is one example. I mean, we train thousands of Latin American military people in various art forms, including bombing and assassination, although we didn't call it that, and torture. We didn't call it that either. That was called methods of interrogation. We taught them all these fine arts, and they've gone back home, and they have, over the decades, created quite a few very brutal military dictatorships, especially in the southern half of South America, and also in Central America. And so the people south of the border have the School of the Americas as one object of their hatred.
As well as it looks like the U.S. has for years been harboring military leaders who have carried out terroristic activities.
Yeah. Colin Powell condemned last week, he condemned, quote, people who feel that with the destruction of buildings, with the murder of people, they can somehow achieve a political purpose, unquote. Now, doesn't that precisely describe what the U.S. did 2 years ago when it bombed Yugoslavia for 78 days and nights? And is this not the same Colin Powell who directed the horrific bombings of Panama and Iraq? I think our leaders think that no one has any memory, or maybe they simply don't care what we think. And then Bush and other officials have emphasized that it's not only terrorists that the U.S. is going to be waging war against, it's any nation which harbors terrorists. Well, there are very few, if any, nations that have harbored more terrorists than the U.S. has. As one example, the anti-Castro Cubans in Miami, who have carried out hundreds, if not thousands, of terrorist acts in the U.S., in Cuba, and elsewhere, all kinds of murders and bombings. They have been harbored here in safety for decades, as have numerous other terrorists, torturers, and human rights violators from Latin America and Indonesia and elsewhere. So, you know, when Bush speaks of waging war against any nations harboring terrorists, is he planning to wage war against the U.S.?
One of the things you include in your book is a extensive list of votes in the United Nations that the U.S. has been the lone holdout on.
Yeah, either the lone holdout or maybe together with Israel and occasionally one other nation. It's full of votes like 145-1, 121-2. It covers 10 years and showing all kinds of progressive motions before the General Assembly, which the U.S. voted against, and often as the only negative vote. Sometimes these votes had to do with the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Other times they had to do with South Africa, like one in 1979, to end all military and nuclear collaboration with apartheid South Africa. The vote was 114 in favor and 3 against, and the 3 were the U.S., France, and the U.K. South Africa and Israel were two of the main issues on these votes, but there are all kinds of others. I have a wide selection. The U.S. even voted against the idea that food is a right, that people have a right to food. That was in the 80s. They've said the same thing again even recently. This year, they repeated that same opinion. Anyhow, this list runs from 1978 to 1987. It's a 10-year period I chose at random to show how the U.S. stood alone on all these important issues. And I close with a table showing the vote on the resolution of ending the U.S. embargo against Cuba beginning in 1992. And it began with 59 countries supporting that to 88, 101, and it keeps increasing each year. And the U.S. and Israel have voted against it every year, and a few times they were joined by Uzbekistan, which oddly enough is now all set to help the U.S. in whatever it wants to do in that area, like an invade Afghanistan.
So it in itself, if not the rest of the book, again, seems to so clearly show why so many people have a problem with U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah. The book is called A Guide. I mean, I don't go into everything in super detail, but enough to give one the flavor and the idea. I have another book called Killing Hope, U.S. Military and CIA Intervention Since World War II, is based on U.S. interventions in about 70 countries, and that goes into great detail, showing how we overthrew governments and suppressed rebellions and assassinated people and so on. In Rogue State, I have a more concise listing of that, although I've added quite a few to the list. Each one is explained concisely, not in full detail.
Let me ask you, I mean, you left the State Department back during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
And now you've produced these two books, and it doesn't seem like things are getting any better. Is that true?
I hadn't expected I would change the world.
What do you see as the possible futures here for the U.S.? Do you think the peace movement is going to eventually solve things? Or
I think the peace movement first has to overcome this, I will use a word now which may offend some of your listeners, but this disease called patriotism. I'm very much against patriotism, which I equate with nationalism. Those forces have caused more harm and suffering and deaths in the world than even religion has, and that's saying quite a bit, you know, over the centuries. And right now, people are caught up in this patriotic frenzy. No one has the courage to say anything which might imply any criticism of the government. Even in New York, they all of a sudden now, they all love Mayor Giuliani. The Sierra Club, the one of the leading environmental groups, has called off any criticism of George Bush's policies for the foreseeable future. This will pass. I mean, people will suddenly realize that they can't just be suckered in like that into this blanket thing called patriotism, and they will, I think, show more spunk. This Saturday there's going to be major demos in Washington, where I live, and on the West Coast as well, I believe. And I'm curious to see what the signs and the pamphlets say. I'm curious to see whether they have passed this freeze brought on by patriotism, and whether they feel free again to be very critical.
And again, since you were there during the Vietnam War, do you think things are better or worse in terms of people coming forward and speaking their minds now?
Well, at the very moment, they're worse because of what happened. But until that happened, the globalization movement, or the anti-globalization movement, I was very encouraged by. It was much more widespread than was the anti-war movement. All kinds of people, including many who are otherwise conservative, were involved in the anti-globalization movement. And I think once this current feeling over what happened fades away and calms down, that we'll see a return to what was a very growing and militant movement.
All right, well, with that, I wanted to give you a chance to put any last words, convey them to our listeners.
Well, if anyone wants to purchase a copy of my book, they can email me at bblum6@aol.com, and I can send out inscribed copies. But apart from my plug, I spoke a few days ago on a campus, and I said this: if I were the president, I could stop terrorist attacks against the U.S. in a few days, permanently. I would first apologize to all the widows and orphans, the tortured and impoverished, and all the many millions of other victims of American imperialism. Then I would announce that America's global interventions have come to an end. I would then reduce the military budget by at least 90% and use the savings to pay reparations to the victims. That would be my first 2 days in office.
And what would be the third day?
Third day, I would be assassinated, for sure, if I lasted that long. And then they would blame it on some lone nut. But don't believe it. I'm giving you warning in advance. It will not be a lone nut.